hard to build. Nearly a month passed as he stayed away from the church. His melancholy became a full-fledged depression, darker than anything he had experienced before. He wasn't certain if he would ever become healthy enough to return. Warren, as befitting a pastor, is a man prone to epiphanies. They had occurred when he found the magazine article about McGavran, and in the library in Texas. Walking through the desert, another one struck. "You focus on building people," the Lord told him, "and I will build the church." Unlike some of his previous revelations, however, this one didn't suddenly make the path clear. Warren would continue to struggle with depression for months, and then during periods throughout his life. On that day, however, he made two decisions. He would go back to Saddleback, and he would figure out how to make running the church less work. When Warren returned to Saddleback, he decided to expand a small experiment he had started a few months earlier that he hoped would make it easier to manage the church. He was never certain he would have enough classrooms to accommodate everyone who showed up for Bible study, so he had asked a few church members to host classes inside their homes. He worried that people might complain about going to someone's house rather than a proper church classroom. But congregants loved it, they said. The small groups gave them a chance to meet their neighbors. So after he returned from his leave, Warren assigned every Saddleback member to a small group that met every week. It was one of the most important decisions he ever made, because it transformed church participation from a decision into a habit that drew on already existing social urges and patterns. Now, when people come to Saddleback and see the giant crowds on the weekends, they think that's our success, Warren told me. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. 95% of this church is what happens during the week inside those small groups. The congregation and the small groups are like a 1-2 punch. You have this big crowd to remind you why you're doing this in the first place, and a small group of close friends to help you focus on how to be faithful. Together, they're like glue. We have over 5,000 small groups now. It's the only thing that makes a church this size manageable. Otherwise, I'd work myself to death, and 95% of the congregation would never receive the attention they came here looking for. Without realizing it, Warren, in some ways, has replicated the structure that propelled the Montgomery bus boycott, though he has done it in reverse. That boycott started among people who knew Rosa Parks and became a mass protest when the weak ties of the community compelled participation. At Saddleback Church, it works the other way around. People are attracted by a sense of community and the weak ties that a congregation offers. Then once inside, they're pushed into a small group of neighbors, a petri dish, if you will, for growing close ties, where their faith becomes an aspect of their social experience and daily lives. Creating small groups, however, isn't enough. When Warren asked people what they discussed in one another's living rooms, he discovered they talked about the Bible and prayed together for 10 minutes, and then spent the rest of the time discussing kids or gossiping. Warren's goal, however, wasn't just to help people make new friends. It was to build a community of the faithful, to encourage people to accept the lessons of Christ, and to make faith a focus of their lives. His small groups had created tight bonds, but without leadership, they weren't much more than a coffee circle. They weren't fulfilling his religious expectations. Warren thought back to McGavran, the author. McGavran's philosophy said that if you teach people to live with Christian habits, they'll act as Christians without requiring constant guidance and monitoring. Warren couldn't lead every single small group in person. He couldn't be there to make sure every conversation focused on Christ instead of the latest TV shows. But if he gave people new habits, he figured, he wouldn't need to. When people gathered, their instincts would be to discuss the Bible, to pray together, to embody their faith. So Warren created a series of curriculums used in church classes and small group discussions, which were explicitly designed to teach parishioners new habits. If you want to have Christ-like character, then you just develop the habits that Christ had. One of Saddleback's course manuals reads, "All of us are simply a bundle of habits. Our goal is to help you replace some bad habits with some good habits that will help you grow in Christ's likeness." Every Saddleback member is asked to sign a maturity covenant card promising to adhere to three habits: daily quiet time for reflection and prayer, tithing 10% of their income, and membership in a small group. Giving everyone new habits has become a focus of the church. Once we do that, the responsibility for spiritual growth is no longer with me, it's with you. "We've given you a recipe," Warren told me. "We don't have to guide you, because you're guiding yourself." These habits become a new self-identity, and at that point, we just need to support you and get out of your way. Warren's insight was that he could expand his church the same way Martin Luther King grew the boycott, by relying on the combination of strong and weak ties. Transforming his church into a movement, however, scaling it across 20,000 parishioners and thousands of other pastors, required something more, something that made it self-perpetuating. Warren needed to teach people habits that caused them to live faithfully, not because of their ties, but because it's who they are. This is the third aspect of how social habits drive movements. For an idea to grow beyond a community, it must become self-propelling. And the surest way to achieve that is to give people new habits that help them figure out where to go on their own. As the bus boycott expanded from a few days into a week, and then a month, and then 2 months, the commitment of Montgomery's black community began to wane. The police commissioner, citing an ordinance that required taxicabs to charge a minimum fare, threatened to arrest cabbies who drove blacks to work at a discount. The boycott's leaders responded by signing up 200 volunteers to participate in a carpool. Police started issuing tickets and harassing people at carpool meeting spots. Drivers began dropping out. "It became more and more difficult to catch a ride," King later wrote. Complaints began to rise. "From early morning to late at night, my telephone rang, and my doorbell was seldom silent. I began to have doubts about the ability of the Negro community to continue the struggle." One night, while King was preaching at his church, an usher ran up with an urgent message. A bomb had exploded at King's house while his wife and infant daughter were inside. King rushed home and was greeted by a crowd of several hundred blacks, as well as the mayor and chief of police. His family had not been injured, but the front windows of his home were shattered, and there was a crater in his porch. If anyone had been in the front rooms of the house when the bomb went off, they would have been killed. As King surveyed the damage, more and more blacks arrived. Policemen started telling the crowds to disperse. Someone shoved a cop. A bottle flew through the air. One of the policemen swung a baton. The police chief, who months earlier had publicly declared his support for the racist White Citizens Council, pulled King aside and asked him to do something, anything, to stop a riot from breaking out. King walked to his porch. "Don't do anything panicky," he shouted to the crowd. "Don't get your weapons. He who lives by the sword shall perish by the sword." The crowd grew still. "We must love our white brothers, no matter what they do to us," King said. "We must make them know that we love them." Jesus still cries out in words that echo across the centuries, "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you." It was the message of nonviolence that King had been increasingly preaching for weeks. Its theme, which drew on the writings of Gandhi and Jesus' sermons, was in many ways an argument listeners hadn't heard in this context before. A plea for nonviolent activism, overwhelming love and forgiveness of their attackers, and a promise that it would bring victory. For years, the civil rights movement had been kept alive by couching itself in the language of battles and struggles. There were contests and setbacks, triumphs and defeats, that required everyone to recommit to the fight. King gave people a new lens. This wasn't a war, he said. It was an embrace. Equally important, King cast the boycott in a new and different light. This was not just about equality on buses, King said. It was part of God's plan. The same destiny that had ended British colonialism in India and slavery in the United States, and that had caused Christ to die on the cross so that he could take away our sins. It was the newest stage in a movement that had started centuries earlier. And as such, it required new responses, different strategies and behaviors. It needed participants to offer the other cheek. People could show their allegiance by adopting the new habits King was evangelizing about. "We must meet hate with love," King told the crowd the night of the bombing. "If I am stopped, our work will not stop. For what we are doing is right, what we are doing is just, and God is with us." When King was done speaking, the crowd quietly walked home. "If it hadn't been for that nigger preacher," one white policeman later said, "we'd all be dead." The next week, 2 dozen new drivers signed up for the carpool. The phone calls to King's home slowed. People began self-organizing, taking leadership of the boycott, propelling the movement. When more bombs exploded on the lawns of other boycott organizers, the same pattern played out. Montgomery's blacks showed up en masse, bore witness without violence or confrontation, and then went home. It wasn't just in response to violence that this self-directed unity became visible. The churches started holding mass meetings every week, sometimes every night. They were kind of like Dr. King's speech after the bombing. "They took Christian teachings and made them political," Taylor Branch told me. A movement is a saga. For it to work, everyone's identity has to change. People in Montgomery had to learn a new way to act. Much like Alcoholics Anonymous, which draws power from group meetings where addicts learn new habits and start to believe by watching others demonstrate their faith, so Montgomery's citizens learned in mass meetings new behaviors that expanded the movement. "People went to see how other people were handling it," said Branch. "You start to see yourself as part of a vast social enterprise, and after a while, you really believe you are." When the Montgomery police resorted to mass arrests to stop the boycott 3 months after it started, the community embraced the oppression. When 90 people were indicted by a grand jury, almost all of them rushed to the courthouse to present themselves for arrest. Some people went to the sheriff's office to see if their names were on the list and were disappointed when they were not, King later wrote. A once fear-ridden people had been transformed. In future years, as the movement spread and there were waves of killing and attacks, arrests and beatings, the protesters, rather than fighting back, retreating, or using tactics that in the years before Montgomery had been activist mainstays, simply stood their ground and told white vigilantes that they were ready to forgive them when their hatred had ceased. Instead of stopping the movement, The opposition's tactics had only served to give it greater momentum and to draw us closer together, King wrote. They thought they were dealing with a group who could be cajoled or forced to do whatever the white man wanted them to do. They were not aware that they were dealing with Negroes who had been freed from fear. There are, of course, numerous and complex reasons why the Montgomery bus boycott succeeded, and why it became the spark for a movement that would spread across the South. But one critical factor is this third aspect of social habits. Embedded within King's philosophy was a set of new behaviors that converted participants from followers into self-directing leaders. These are not habits as we conventionally think about them. However, when King recast Montgomery's struggle by giving protesters a new sense of self-identity, the protest became a movement fueled by people who were acting because they had taken ownership of a historic event. And that social pattern, over time, became automatic and expanded to other places and groups of students and protesters whom King never met, but who could take on leadership of the movement simply by watching how its participants habitually behaved. On June 5, 1956, a panel of federal judges ruled that Montgomery's bus segregation law violated the Constitution. The city appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and on December 17th, more than a year after Parks was arrested, the highest court rejected the final appeal. 3 days later, city officials received the order. The buses had to be integrated. The next morning at 5:55 a.m., King, E.D. Nixon, Ralph Abernathy, and others climbed on board a city bus for the first time in more than 12 months and sat in the front. "I believe you are Reverend King, aren't you?" asked the white driver. "Yes, I am." "We are very glad to have you this morning," the driver said. Later, NAACP attorney and future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall would claim that the boycott had little to do with ending bus segregation in Montgomery. It was the Supreme Court, not capitulation by either side, that changed the law. "All that walking for nothing," Marshall said. "They could just as well have waited while the bus case went up through the courts, without all the work and worry of the boycott." Marshall, however, was wrong in one important respect. The Montgomery bus boycott helped birth a new set of social habits that quickly spread to Greensboro, North Carolina, Selma, Alabama, and Little Rock, Arkansas. The civil rights movement became a wave of sit-ins and peaceful demonstrations, even as participants were violently beaten. By the early 1960s, it had moved to Florida, California, Washington, D.C., and the halls of Congress. When President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlawed all forms of segregation as well as discrimination against minorities and women, he equated the civil rights activists to the nation's founders, a comparison that, a decade earlier, would have been political suicide. 188 years ago this week, a small band of valiant men began a long struggle for freedom, he told television cameras. Now our generation of Americans has been called on to continue the unending search for justice within our own borders. Movements don't emerge because everyone suddenly decides to face the same direction at once. They rely on social patterns that begin as the habits of friendship, grow through the habits of communities, and are sustained by new habits that change participants' sense of self. King saw the power of these habits as early as Montgomery. "I cannot close without giving just a word of caution," he told a packed church on the night he called off the boycott. There was still almost a decade of protest ahead of him, but the end was in sight. As we go back to the buses, let us be loving enough to turn an enemy into a friend. We must now move from protest to reconciliation. With this dedication, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man, to the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. Chapter 9. The Neurology of Free Will. Are we responsible for our habits? 1. The morning the trouble began, years before she realized there was even trouble in the first place, Angie Bachman was sitting at home, staring at the television, so bored that she was giving serious thought to reorganizing the silverware drawer. Her youngest daughter had started kindergarten a few weeks earlier, and her two older daughters were in middle school, their lives filled with friends and activities and gossip their mother couldn't possibly understand. Her husband, a land surveyor, often left for work at 8 and didn't get home until 6. The house was empty except for Bachman. It was the first time in almost 2 decades since she had gotten married at 19 and pregnant by 20, and her days had become crowded with packing school lunches, playing princess, and basically running a family car shuttle service, that she felt genuinely alone. In high school, her friends told her she should become a model. She had been that pretty. But when she dropped out and then married a guitar player who eventually got a real job, she settled on being a mom instead. Now it was 10:30 in the morning. Her 3 daughters were gone, and Bachman had resorted, again, to taping a piece of paper over the kitchen clock to stop herself from looking at it every 3 minutes. She had no idea what to do next. That day, she made a deal with herself. If she could make it until noon without going crazy or eating the cake in the fridge, she would leave the house and do something fun. She spent the next 90 minutes trying to figure out what exactly that would be. When the clock hit 12 o'clock, she put on some makeup and a nice dress and drove to a riverboat casino about 20 minutes away from her house. Even at noon on a Thursday, the casino was filled with people doing things besides watching soap operas and folding the laundry. There was a band playing near the entrance. A woman was handing out free cocktails. Bachman ate shrimp from a buffet. The whole experience felt luxurious, like playing hooky. She made her way to a blackjack table where a dealer patiently explained the rules. When her $40 of chips were gone, she glanced at her watch and saw 2 hours had flown by, and she needed to hurry home to pick up her youngest daughter. That night at dinner, for the first time in a month, she had something to talk about besides outguessing a contestant on The Price is Right. Angie Bachman's father was a truck driver who had remade himself midlife into a semi-famous songwriter. Her brother had become a songwriter too and had won awards. Bachman, on the other hand, was often introduced by her parents as the one who became a mom. "I always felt like the untalented one," she told me. "I think I'm smart, and I know I was a good mom. But there wasn't a lot I could point to and say, that's why I'm special." After that first trip to the casino, Bachman started going to the riverboat once a week on Friday afternoons. It was a reward for making it through empty days, keeping the house clean, staying sane. She knew gambling could lead to trouble, so she set strict rules for herself. No more than 1 hour at the blackjack table per trip, and she only gambled what was in her wallet. "I considered it kind of like a job," she told me. "I never left the house before noon, and I was always home in time to pick up my daughter. I was very disciplined." And she got good. At first, she could hardly make her money last an hour. Within 6 months, however, she had picked up enough tricks that she adjusted her rules to allow for 2 or 3 hour shifts, and she would still have cash in her pocket when she walked away. One afternoon, she sat down at the blackjack table with $80 in her purse and left with $530, enough to buy groceries, pay the phone bill, and put a bid in the rainy day fund. By then, the company that owned the casino, Harrah's Entertainment, was sending her coupons for free buffets. She would treat the family to dinner on Saturday nights. The state where Bachman was gambling, Iowa, had legalized gambling only a few years earlier. Prior to 1989, the state's lawmakers worried that the temptations of cards and dice might be difficult for some citizens to resist. It was a concern as old as the nation itself. Gambling is the child of avarice, the brother of iniquity, and the father of mischief, George Washington wrote in 1783. This is a vice which is productive of every possible evil. In a word, few gain by this abominable practice, while thousands are injured. Protecting people from their bad habits, in fact, defining which habits should be considered bad in the first place, is a prerogative lawmakers have eagerly seized. Prostitution, gambling, liquor sales on the Sabbath, pornography, usurious loans, sexual relations outside of marriage, or if your tastes are unusual, within marriage, are all habits that various legislatures have regulated, outlawed, or tried to discourage with strict and often ineffective laws. When Iowa legalized casinos, lawmakers were sufficiently concerned that they limited the activity to riverboats and mandated that no one could wager more than $5 per bet, with a maximum loss of $200 per person per cruise. Within a few years, however, after some of the state's casinos moved to Mississippi, where no limit gaming was allowed, the Iowa legislature lifted those restrictions. In 2010, the state's coffers swelled by more than $269 million from taxes on gambling. In 2000, Angie Bachman's parents, both longtime smokers, started showing signs of lung disease. She began flying to Tennessee to see them every other week, buying groceries and helping to cook dinner. When she came back home to her husband and daughters, the stretches seemed even lonelier now. Sometimes the house was empty all day long. It was as if, in her absence, her friends had forgotten to invite her to things, and her family had figured out how to get by on their own. Bachman was worried about her parents, upset that her husband seemed more interested in his work than her anxieties, and resentful of her kids, who didn't realize she needed them now, after all the sacrifices she had made while they were growing up. But whenever she hit the casino, those tensions would float away. She started going a couple times a week when she wasn't visiting her parents, and then every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. She still had rules, but she'd been gambling for years by now, and knew the axioms that serious players lived by. She never put down less than $25 a hand, and always played two hands at once. You have better odds at a higher limit table than at a lower limit table, she told me. You have to be able to play through the rough patches until your luck turns. I've seen people walk in with $150 and win $10,000. I knew I could do this if I followed my rules. I was in control. By then, she didn't have to think about whether to take another card or double her bet. She acted automatically, just as Eugene Pauly, the amnesiac, had eventually learned to always choose the right cardboard rectangle. One day in 2000, Bachman went home from the casino with $6,000, enough to pay rent for 2 months and wipe out the credit card bills that were piling up by the front door. Another time she walked away with $2,000. Sometimes she lost, but that was part of the game. Smart gamblers knew you had to go down to go up. Eventually, Harrah's gave her a line of credit so she wouldn't have to carry so much cash. Other players sought her out and sat at her table because she knew what she was doing. At the buffet, the hosts would let her go to the front of the line. I know how to play, she told me. I know that sounds like somebody who's got a problem not recognizing their problem, but the only mistake I made was not quitting. There wasn't anything wrong with how I played. Bachman's rules gradually became more flexible as the size of her winnings and losses expanded. One day she lost $800 in an hour, and then earned $1,200 in 40 minutes. Then her luck turned again, and she walked away down $4,000. Another time she lost $3,500 in the morning, earned $5,000 by 1 p.m., and lost another $3,000 in the afternoon. The casino had records of how much she owed and what she'd earned. She'd stopped keeping track herself. Then one month, she didn't have enough in her bank account for the electricity bill. She asked her parents for a small loan, and then another. She borrowed $2,000 one month, $2,500 the next. It wasn't a big deal. They had the money. Bachman had never had problems with drinking or drugs or overeating. She was a normal mom, with the same highs and lows as everyone else. So the compulsion she felt to gamble, the insistent pull that made her feel distracted or irritable on days when she didn't visit the casino, the way she found herself thinking about it all the time, the rush she felt on a good run, caught her completely off guard. It was a new sensation, so unexpected that she hardly knew it was a problem until it had taken hold of her life. In retrospect, it seemed like there had been no dividing line. One day it was fun, and the next it was uncontrollable. By 2001, she was going to the casino every day. She went whenever she fought with her husband or felt unappreciated by her kids. At the tables, she was numb and excited all at once, and her anxieties grew so faint she couldn't hear them anymore. The high of winning was so immediate. The pain of losing passed so fast. "You want to be a big shot," her mother told her when Bachman called to borrow more money. "You keep gambling because you want the attention." That wasn't it, though. "I just wanted to feel good at something," she said to me. "This was the only thing I'd ever done where it seemed like I had a skill." By the summer of 2001, Bachman's debts to Harrah's hit $20,000. She had been keeping the losses secret from her husband. But when her mother finally cut off the stipends, she broke down and confessed. They hired a bankruptcy attorney, cut up her credit cards, and sat at the kitchen table to write out a plan for a more austere, responsible life. She took her dresses to a used clothing store and withstood the humiliation of a 19-year-old turning down almost all of them because she said they were out of style. Eventually, it started to feel like the worst was over. Finally, she thought, the compulsion was gone. But of course, it wasn't even close to the end. Years later, after she had lost everything and had ruined her life and her husband's, after she had thrown away hundreds of thousands of dollars and her lawyer had argued before the state's highest court that Angie Bachman gambled not by choice but out of habit, and thus shouldn't bear culpability for her losses, after she had become an object of scorn on the Internet, where people compared her to Jeffrey Dahmer and parents who abused their kids, she would wonder, how much responsibility do I actually bear? "I honestly believe anyone in my shoes would have done the same things," Bachman told me. 2. On a July morning in 2008, a desperate man vacationing along the west coast of Wales picked up the phone and called an emergency operator. "I think I've killed my wife," he said. "Oh my God. I thought someone had broken in. I was fighting with those boys, but it was Christine. I must have been dreaming or something. What have I done? What have I done?" 10 minutes later, Police officers arrived to find Brian Thomas crying next to his camper van. The previous night, he explained, he and his wife had been sleeping in the van when young men racing around the parking lot had awoken them. They moved their camper to the edge of the lot and went back to sleep. Then, a few hours later, Thomas woke to find a man in jeans and a black fleece, one of the racers, he thought, lying on top of his wife. He screamed at the man, grabbed him by the throat, and tried to pull him off. It was as if he was reacting automatically, he told the police. The more the man struggled, the harder Thomas squeezed. The man scratched at Thomas's arm and tried to fight back, but Thomas choked tighter and tighter, and eventually the man stopped moving. Then, Thomas realized it wasn't a man in his hands, but his wife. He dropped her body and began gently nudging her shoulder, trying to wake her, asking if she was all right. It was too late. "I thought somebody had broken in, and I strangled her," Thomas told the police, sobbing. "She's my world." For the next 10 months, as Thomas sat in prison awaiting trial, a portrait of the murderer emerged. As a child, Thomas had started sleepwalking, sometimes multiple times each night. He would get out of bed, walk around the house and play with toys or fix himself something to eat, and the next morning remember nothing about what he had done. It became a family joke. Once a week, it seemed, he would wander into the yard or someone else's room, all while asleep. It was a habit, his mother would explain, when neighbors asked why her son was walking across their lawns barefoot and in his pajamas. As he grew older, he would wake up with cuts on his feet and no memories of where they had come from. He once swam in a canal in his sleep. After he married, his wife grew so concerned about the possibility that he might stumble out of the house and into traffic that she locked the door and slept with the keys under her pillow. Every night, the couple would crawl into bed and have a kiss and a cuddle, Thomas later said. And then he would go to his own room and sleep in his own bed. Otherwise, his restless tossing and turning, the shouting and grunting and occasional wanderings, would keep Christine up all night. "Sleepwalking is a reminder that wake and sleep are not mutually exclusive," Mark Mahold, a professor of neurology at the University of Minnesota and a pioneer in understanding sleep behaviors, told me. "The part of your brain that monitors your behavior is asleep, but the parts capable of very complex activities are awake. The problem is that there's nothing guiding the brain except for basic patterns, your most basic habits. You follow what exists in your head because you're not capable of making a choice." By law, the police had to prosecute Thomas for the murder. But all evidence seemed to indicate that he and his wife had a happy marriage prior to that awful night. There wasn't any history of abuse. They had 2 grown daughters and had recently booked a Mediterranean cruise to celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary. Prosecutors asked a sleep specialist, Dr. Chris Idzikowski of the Edinburgh Sleep Center, to examine Thomas and evaluate a theory that he had been unconscious when he killed his wife. In 2 separate sessions, one in Idzikowski's laboratory and the other inside the prison, the researcher applied sensors all over Thomas's body and measured his brain waves, eye movement, chin and leg muscles, nasal airflow, respiratory effort, and oxygen levels while he slept. Thomas wasn't the first person to argue that he had committed a crime while sleeping, and thus, by extension, should not be held responsible for his deed. There's a long history of wrongdoers contending they aren't culpable due to automatism, as sleepwalking and other unconscious behaviors are known. And in the past decade, as our understanding of the neurology of habits and free will has become more sophisticated, those defenses have become more compelling. Society, as embodied by our courts and juries, has agreed that some habits are so powerful that they overwhelm our capacity to make choices, and thus we're not responsible for what we do. Sleepwalking is an odd outgrowth of a normal aspect of how our brains work while we slumber. Most of the time, as our bodies move in and out of different phases of rest, our most primitive neurological structure, the brainstem, paralyzes our limbs and nervous system, allowing our brains to experience dreams without our bodies moving. Usually, people can make the transition in and out of paralysis multiple times each night without any problems. Within neurology, it's known as the switch. Some people's brains, though, experience switching errors. They go into incomplete paralysis as they sleep, and their bodies are active while they dream or pass between sleep phases. This is the root cause of sleepwalking, and for the majority of sufferers, it is an annoying but benign problem. Someone might dream about eating a cake, for instance, and the next morning find a ravaged box of donuts in the kitchen. Someone will dream about going to the bathroom and later discover a wet spot in the hall. Sleepwalkers can behave in complex ways. For instance, they can open their eyes, see, move around, and drive a car or cook a meal, all while essentially unconscious because the parts of their brain associated with seeing, walking, driving, and cooking can function while they are asleep, without input from the brain's more advanced regions, such as the prefrontal cortex. Sleepwalkers have been known to boil water and make tea. One operated a motorboat. Another turned on an electric saw and started feeding in pieces of wood before going back to bed. But in general, sleepwalkers will not do things that are dangerous to themselves or others. Even asleep, there is an instinct to avoid peril. However, as scientists have examined the brains of sleepwalkers, they've found a distinction between sleepwalking, in which people might leave their beds and start acting out their dreams or other mild impulses, and something called sleep terrors. When a sleep terror occurs, the activity inside people's brains is markedly different from when they are awake, semi-conscious, or even sleepwalking. People in the midst of sleep terrors seem to be in the grip of terrible anxieties, but are not dreaming in the normal sense of the word. Their brains shut down, except for the most primitive neurological regions, which include what are known as central pattern generators. These areas of the brain are the same ones studied by Dr. Larry Squire and the scientists at MIT, who found the neurological machinery of the habit loop. To a neurologist, in fact, a brain experiencing a sleep terror looks very similar to a brain following a habit. The behaviors of people in the grip of sleep terrors are habits, though of the most primal kind. The central pattern generators at work during a sleep terror are where such behavioral patterns as walking, breathing, flinching from a loud noise, or fighting at an attacker come from. We don't usually think about these behaviors as habits, but that's what they are. Automatic behaviors so ingrained in our neurology that studies show they can occur with almost no input from the higher regions of the brain. However, these habits, when they occur during sleep terrors, are different in one critical respect. Because sleep deactivates the prefrontal cortex and other high cognition areas, when a sleep terror habit is triggered, there is no possibility of conscious intervention. If the fight or flight habit is cued by a sleep terror, there is no chance that someone can override it through logic or reason. People with sleep terrors aren't dreaming in the normal sense, said Mahold, the neurologist. There's no complex plots like you and I remember from a nightmare. If they remember anything afterward, it's just an image or emotions, impending doom, horrible fear, the need to defend themselves or someone else. Those emotions are really powerful, though. They are some of the most basic cues for all kinds of behaviors we've learned throughout our lives. Responding to a threat by running away or defending ourselves is something everyone has practiced since they were babies. And when those emotions occur, and there's no chance for the higher brain to put things in context, we react the way our deepest habits tell us to. We run or fight or follow whatever behavioral pattern is easiest for our brains to latch onto. When someone in the midst of a sleep terror starts feeling threatened or sexually aroused, two of the most common sleep terror experiences, they react by following the habits associated with those stimuli. People experiencing sleep terrors have jumped off of tall roofs because they believed they were fleeing from attackers. They have killed their own babies because they believed they were fighting wild animals. They have raped their spouses, even as their victims begged them to stop. Because once the sleeper's arousal began, they followed the ingrained habit to satisfy the urge. Sleepwalking seems to allow some choice, some participation by our higher brains that tell us to stay away from the edge of the roof. Someone in the grip of a sleep terror, however, simply follows the habit loop, no matter where it leads. Some scientists suspect sleep terrors might be genetic. Others say diseases such as Parkinson's make them more likely. Their causes aren't well understood. But for a number of people, sleep terrors involve violent impulses. Violence related to sleep terrors appears to be a reaction to a concrete, frightening image that the individual can subsequently describe, a group of Swiss researchers wrote in 2009. Among people suffering one type of sleep dysfunction, attempted assault of sleep partners has been reported to occur in 64% of cases, with injuries in 3%. In both the United States and the United Kingdom, there is a history of murderers arguing that sleep terrors caused them to commit crimes they would have never consciously carried out. 4 years before Thomas was arrested, for instance, a man named Jules Lowe was found not guilty of murdering his 83-year-old father after claiming that the attack occurred during a sleep terror. Prosecutors argued it was far-fetched in the extreme to believe that Lowe was asleep while he punched, kicked, and stamped his father for more than 20 minutes, leaving him with over 90 injuries. The jury disagreed and set him free. In September 2008, 33-year-old Donna Shepherd Saunders nearly suffocated her mother by holding a pillow over her face for 30 seconds. She was later acquitted of attempted murder by arguing that she had acted while asleep. In 2009, a British soldier admitted to raping a teenage girl, but said he was asleep and unconscious while he undressed himself, pulled down her pants, and began having sex. When he woke mid-rape, he apologized and called the police. "I've just sort of committed a crime," he told the emergency operator. "I honestly don't know what happened. I woke up on top of her." He had a history of suffering from sleep terrors and was found not guilty. More than 150 murderers and rapists have escaped punishment in the past century using the automatism defense. Judges and juries, acting on behalf of society, have said that since the criminals didn't choose to commit their crimes, since they didn't consciously participate in the violence, they shouldn't bear the blame. For Brian Thomas, it also looked like a situation where a sleep disorder, rather than a murderous impulse, was at fault. "I'll never forgive myself. Ever," he told one of the prosecutors. "Why did I do it?" After Dr. Idzikowski, the sleep specialist, observed Thomas in his laboratory, he submitted his findings. Thomas was asleep when he killed his wife. He hadn't consciously committed a crime. As the trial started, prosecutors presented their evidence to the jury. Thomas had admitted to murdering his wife, they told jurors. He He knew he had a history of sleepwalking. His failure to take precautions while on vacation, they said, made him responsible for his crime. But as arguments proceeded, it became clear prosecutors were fighting an uphill battle. Thomas's lawyer argued that his client hadn't meant to kill his wife. In fact, he wasn't even in control of his own actions that night. Instead, he was reacting automatically to a perceived threat. He was following a habit almost as old as our species, the instinct to fight an attacker and protect a loved one. Once the most primitive parts of his brain were exposed to a cue, someone strangling his wife, his habit took over and he fought back, with no chance of his higher cognition interceding. Thomas was guilty of nothing more than being human, the lawyer argued, and reacting in the way his neurology and most primitive habits forced him to behave. Even the prosecution's own witnesses seemed to bolster the defense. Though Thomas had known he was capable of sleepwalking, the prosecution's own psychiatrist said there was nothing to suggest to him that it was therefore foreseeable he might kill. He had never attacked anyone in his sleep before. He had never previously harmed his wife. When the prosecution's chief psychiatrist took the stand, Thomas's lawyer began his cross-examination. Did it seem fair that Thomas should be found guilty for an act he could not know was going to occur? In her opinion, said Dr. Caroline Jacob, Thomas could not have reasonably anticipated his crime. And if he was convicted and sentenced to Broadmoor Hospital, where some of Britain's most dangerous and mentally ill criminals were housed, well, he does not belong there. The next morning, the head prosecutor addressed the jury. At the time of the killing, the defendant was asleep, and his mind had no control over what his body was doing, he said. We have reached the conclusion that the public interest would no longer be served by continuing to seek a special verdict from you. We therefore offer no further evidence and invite you to return a straight, not guilty verdict. The jury did so. Before Thomas was set free, the judge told him, You are a decent man and a devoted husband. I strongly suspect you may well be feeling a sense of guilt. In the eyes of the law, you bear no responsibility. You are discharged. It seems like a fair outcome. After all, Thomas was obviously devastated by his crime. He had no idea what he was doing when he acted. He was simply following a habit, and his capacity for decision-making was, in effect, incapacitated. Thomas is the most sympathetic murderer conceivable, someone so close to being a victim himself that when the trial ended, the judge tried to console him. Yet many of those same excuses can be made for Angie Bachman, the gambler. She was also devastated by her actions. She would later say she carries a deep sense of guilt. And as it turns out, she was also following deeply ingrained habits that made it increasingly difficult for decision-making to intervene. But in the eyes of the law, Bachman is responsible for her habits, and Thomas isn't. Is it right that Bachman, a gambler, is guiltier than Thomas, a murderer? What does that tell us about the ethics of habit and choice? 3. 3 years after Angie Bachman declared bankruptcy, her father passed away. She'd spent the previous half-decade flying between her home and her parents' house, tending to them as they became increasingly ill. His death was a blow. Then, 2 months later, her mother died. My entire world disintegrated, she said. I would wake up every morning and for a second forget they had passed. And then it would rush in that they were gone, and I'd feel like someone was standing on my chest. I couldn't think about anything else. I didn't know what to do when I got out of bed.
When their wills were read, Bachman learned she had inherited almost $1 million. She used $275,000 to buy her family a new home in Tennessee, near where her mother and father had lived, and spent a bit more to move her grown daughters nearby so everyone was close. Casino gambling wasn't legal in Tennessee, and I didn't want to fall back into bad patterns, she told me. I wanted to live away from anything that reminded me of feeling out of control. She changed her phone numbers and didn't tell the casinos her new address. It felt safer that way. Then one night, driving through her old hometown with her husband, picking up the last of their furniture from her previous home, she started thinking about her parents. How would she manage without them? Why hadn't she been a better daughter? She began hyperventilating. It felt like the beginning of a panic attack. It had been years since she had gambled. But in that moment, she felt like she needed to find something to take her mind off the pain. She looked at her husband. She was desperate. This was a one-time thing. "Let's go to the casino," she said. When they walked in, one of the managers recognized her from when she was a regular and invited them into the players' lounge. He asked how she had been, and it all came tumbling out. Her parents passing, and how hard it had hit her. How exhausted she was all the time. How she felt like she was on the verge of a breakdown. The manager was a good listener. It felt so good to finally say everything she had been thinking and be told that it was normal to feel this way. Then she sat down at a blackjack table and played for 3 hours. For the first time in months, the anxiety faded into background noise. She knew how to do this. She went blank. She lost a few $1,000s. Harrah's Entertainment, the company that owned the casino, was known within the gaming industry for the sophistication of its customer tracking systems. At the core of that system were computer programs much like those Andrew Pohl created at Target. Predictive algorithms that studied gamblers' habits and tried to figure out how to persuade them to spend more. The company assigned players a predicted lifetime value and software built calendars that anticipated how often they would visit and how much they would spend. The company tracked customers through loyalty cards and mailed out coupons for free meals and cash vouchers. Telemarketers called people at home to ask where they had been. Casino employees were trained to encourage visitors to discuss their lives in the hopes they might reveal information that could be used to predict how much they had to gamble with. One Harrah's executive called this approach Pavlovian marketing. The company ran thousands of tests each year to perfect their methods. Customer tracking had increased the company's profits by billions of dollars and was so precise they could track a gambler's spending to the cent and minute. Harrah's, of course, was well aware that Bachman had declared bankruptcy a few years earlier and had walked away from $20,000 in gambling debts. But soon after her conversation with the casino manager, she began receiving phone calls with offers of free limos that would take her to casinos in Mississippi. They offered to fly her and her husband to Lake Tahoe, put them in a suite, and give them tickets to an Eagles concert. "I said my daughter has to come, and she wants to bring a friend," Bachman said. "No problem," the company replied. Everyone's airfare and rooms were free. At the concert, she sat in the front row. Harrah's gave her $10,000 to play with, compliments of the house. The offers kept coming. Every week another casino called, asking if she wanted a limo, entry to shows, plane tickets. Bachman resisted at first, but eventually she started saying yes each time an invitation arrived. When a family friend mentioned that she wanted to get married in Las Vegas, Bachman made a phone call, and the next weekend they were in the Palazzo.
Not that many people even know it exists, she told me. I've called and asked about it, and the operator said it's too exclusive to give out information over the phone. The room was like something out of a movie. It had 6 bedrooms and a